The past comes calling. When I was grown and had two children, friends who knew my family's story began to message me about a 6-part documentary on Bhagwan Shree Rajneesh called Wild Wild Country. The series looked good, they told me. I might find it interesting. But I hesitated. When I was a teenager, I had promised myself that I would try not to expose myself to Bhagwan ever again. I didn't want to see his face, hear his droning voice, or know anything more about the men and women who, like my mother, gave up their loved ones to follow him. He wasn't a man to me, or even just a guru. He was a time and a place, a natural disaster, a force that had wrecked my family. I blamed him for taking my mother away. But the idea of being able to see where my mother had gone and what she had done when she left me and my sister Nava hounded me. The story of Bhagwan and his ashrams was like a distant mythical tale from long ago that I'd been able to only partially piece together from memories and scattered conversations. Now Bhagwan Shree Rajneesh and his ashrams were resurfacing, brought to life again with hours of never-seen-before interviews and footage, and with them the question I didn't realize I've wanted the answer to since the first time she left. Was what Bhagwan gave her worth leaving Nava and me for? On a chilly night during the spring Wild Wild Country aired, I pulled a purple sleeping bag off the back of a chair where it was unzipped and airing out from one of my kids' recent overnights. I gathered it up around me, moving the cold teeth of the zipper away from my chin. My husband pressed start on episode 1, and with my arms crossed tightly against my chest and my body as still as I could make it, I braced myself. When I think of Bhagwan Shree Rajneesh, I see my mother in sunset-colored clothing and a black beaded necklace around her neck, a mala with a photo of Bhagwan's face dangling from the end. This was what all of his sannyasins or followers wore. Now, 40 years later, thousands of them appeared in frame after frame of the documentary. Sannyasins dancing, sannyasins laughing, sannyasins doing ashram chores, sannyasins meditating in a massive pavilion, and hundreds of them lined up along a one-lane road, waiting for the moment when Bhagwan would drive by in one of his 96 Rolls Royces, hoping for a glimpse of their master. I had first seen men and women draped in orange clothing at the meetings my mother took us to a year before she left Nava and me with our father at Newark Airport. What struck me when we went to these meditations was the adults' unusual behavior towards children. They didn't make more than hazy eye contact with us. There wasn't any sense of curiosity that two little ones had arrived, the only kids in the place. No impulse at all to settle us in or help make us feel welcome. Even though people in Seattle seemed pretty reserved, make that really reserved, grown-ups usually tried to be friendly toward us. The way these men and women looked around us, through us, troubled me. I couldn't verbalize my worry then, but it nagged at me that my mother didn't seem to notice that the people she wanted to spend more time with basically ignored her children. I was already becoming more insecure in my attachment to her, but I still knew from my first 4 years of life on a kibbutz in Israel that grown-ups were supposed to guide children and treat them with gentleness. I would later learn that Bhagwan felt children were a distraction, that they made spiritual growth difficult to attain. In fact, he encouraged sterilization and vasectomies for sannyasins on his ashram and later on his ranch in Antelope, Oregon. Decades later, my mother told me herself that Bhagwan taught that children were obstacles to enlightenment. Bhagwan had been a student of philosophy in India and introduced what he coined dynamic meditation back in 1970. That was also the year he initiated his first group of sannyasins for his ashram in Pune. He handpicked new names for the men and women who joined him, and they donned the orange of Hindu holy men and the mala with their master's face. But what set Bhagwan apart from other gurus in India was that he encouraged his sannyasins to embrace a celebratory lifestyle rather than an austere or abstinent one. He lectured in both English and Hindi and espoused sex as the first step to superconsciousness. By 1974, he had a 6-acre ashram in Pune where Westerners flocked to in order to live and work and learn. They took part in therapy groups where, in the early days of the ashram, sex and violence were documented to have been used to help followers reach breakthroughs on their paths to awareness. By 1977, Bhagwan's teachings were gaining momentum in the Western world. He had published multiple books and had his very own Rajneeshi Center in our Capitol Hill neighborhood in Seattle. My mother was on food stamps with no family living nearby and no close network to help her with Nava and me now that my father had left for New Jersey, so she started bringing us to events at the Rajneeshee Center and different Seattle area homes. At the first one she took us to, she settled us on a sofa and found a spot for herself on the floor in the hushed and candlelit room. Perched on my knees to see better, I surveyed the sannyasins and soon-to-be sannyasins from my cushion, how they sat motionless and slack-jawed for almost an hour, while Bhagwan's slow, languorous voice oozed from the speaker on the wall. I'd left Israel a year and a half before and was still new to English, but I caught the unusual way he lingered on certain syllables, how he drew out the S at the end of his words like a tired snake. It was as if he had all the time in the world to say whatever it was he was saying. The tape seemed to last forever, and though at three different times I was certain he was finished making his point, he started up again. Nava had fallen asleep next to me, so she wasn't able to distract me, and I didn't think I could take any more. I wanted to levitate up off the sofa, up past the listless sea of heads around me to another place, where I wasn't trapped listening to this monotonous voice, where I didn't have to go to a stranger's house at night and be near adults who didn't care anything about me. I knew that if my father still lived in Seattle, he would have made sure that I never had to attend one of these gatherings again. I stared at my mother's face in the candlelight, willing her to open her eyes, to feel me trying to connect with her so she'd realize that it was time to leave. It was almost like she'd forgotten I was there, forgotten I was supposed to be home getting ready for bed. I wanted to tiptoe over to her and whisper that this had gone on too long, but I didn't want to get into trouble. I was reliable and compliant. I would never have cried or drawn negative attention to myself. I did what my mother expected me to. Plus, and most importantly, she had promised me there would be cookies at the end of the meeting if I behaved, and that's the real reason I cooperated. She knew I was a pushover for food. Even as a toddler in Israel, wherever we went, I wanted to know if there would be treats. I wish now I had been more of a pain in the neck and much less bribable. Maybe then she wouldn't have lugged us around to so many meetings. Finally, the tape ended, and I watched the adults embrace each other. The lights came on, and my mother drifted back over to collect us. The cookies they served were dry and store-bought, nothing special, definitely not worth sitting through a meditation for. I was sure I wouldn't fall for a bribe like that again, but I did. When the Rajneeshee Center held a party one Sunday afternoon, I cashed in as soon as we arrived and took my graham cracker outside to eat. Part of the backyard was shaded, the ground damp and packed like it is much of the time in Seattle. Other parts were thick and grassy and lit up in startling sunlight. The lawn and the people strewn around it were so bright in places, they appeared almost bleached out. Sannyasins were lying around the grass with languid smiles, some massaging each other. Their eyes stopped just short of focusing on their surroundings. I couldn't tell if they were actually seeing anything they looked at. Aside from Nava, who was with my mother somewhere inside, there were no other children around, so I sat near a woman my mother had introduced me to at another meeting and ate my graham cracker. After a little while, she reached over for my foot and asked me if I'd like a little massage. I'd never had a massage before, but nodded okay because that was easier than telling her no thanks. She rolled her thumbs over the ball of my right foot and pressed in, working her way to my arch, which felt good but also a little strange. After enough moments had passed so as not to be rude, I asked, "Do you want a massage?" And I moved my foot away. I wasn't completely at ease with her handling my body, really for anybody here to handle my body, but offering to do something for her rather than accept something from her felt safer to me. I had a feeling it was a better way to control the situation. No way I was going to touch her feet, though, so I stood behind her and placed my hands on her shoulders and squeezed, the way I saw some of the other adults were doing. I worked my thumbs into her back, kneading with my fingers, trying to replicate what she had done when she massaged me. "You have strong hands," she said. From over her shoulder, I checked her face and she was smiling, so I kept massaging her but with even more enthusiasm. I've always been such a sucker for compliments. I do think I knew this wasn't an ordinary or normal situation. I didn't love being there with her instead of my mother, but I appreciated that this woman had recognized me for being good at something. I had value even if it was only because of the power in my hands. I don't know if hypervigilant kids are made or born, if I would have picked up on everything that was going on around me anyway, or if I became insecure and watchful because I didn't feel my mother watching over me. I don't know what it's like to be free enough as a kid to try anything or wander anywhere because you know your mother is keeping you in mind, that no matter what, you'll be safe because she's focused on you. Part of me sees my mother as strong, tall, busy, with an aura around her I couldn't approach, a combination of contemplation, worry, and a desire to be somewhere better, the side of her that would ultimately push her to find what she was looking for. The other part of me sees the sad, lost side of her, which in many ways was maybe as young and inexperienced as I was. When she and my father left Israel after 8 years on the kibbutz, she didn't even know how to write a check. Now she was a single mother alone in a new city, searching and unsure of how to proceed, about to collapse with the impossibility of being on her own. I see somebody who has never properly mothered herself, who wasn't able to give all of herself, now being forced to drain every last ounce. She was fighting for control of her life, for direction and meaning, as if she were locked in a brutal tug of war. The difficulty was, my sister and I were on the other end of the rope. I had no idea that afternoon on the lawn that I was months away from losing her.